From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Leanne Hansen, sitting in for Terry Gross while she's on vacation. On today's show, a conversation with comic Bob Goldthwait. His manic performances on television, in clubs, and in the Police Academy movies have earned Goldthwait a reputation as one of today's hottest comics. Also today, I speak with photographer Ted Spagna. His photographs of humans and animals asleep are attracting the attention of both artists and scientists. Rhythm guitarist Marty Gross is back with a couple of vintage tunes, and Ken Tucker reviews the home video versions of Double Indemnity and Naked Spur. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. You may remember my guest from his appearances in Police Academy movies. No, he's not the one who makes all the weird sounds. He played the demented motorcycle gang leader Zed, and his name is Bob Goldthwait. He's only 25 years old, but he's already appeared in 3 Police Academy movies, the film One Crazy Summer, and co-starred with Whoopi Goldberg in Burglar. He has made frequent appearances on Late Night with David Letterman, and earlier this year had his own comedy special on home box office called Share the Warmth. Goldthwait gained the nickname Bobcat during his mischievous teen years, and he first began writing comedy material right around the time he reached puberty, and he was already performing in clubs when he was 16 years old. Bob Goldthwait, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you very much. That was quite an elaborate research. I feel like I'm dead, actually. In fact, if I did die now, it'd be pretty good, because that's not outside of being in the police lobotomies, that's pretty an impressive, array of things.
That's a good resume. You gave me an A on it. You gave me a little star.
Yeah, I didn't mark it and correct it. I guess that's kind of rude of me. Actually, thank you very much. It's really nice to be on Fresh Air, something I've never been accused of,
Okay, let's go back.
Let's bring it down to my level.
We're going right back to the beginning of your career. I'm sorry, you're going to have to rehash it all.
No. What is your target audience? I'm trying to figure out.
Intellectual? Absolutely.
Well, yeah, okay. And you're having me on.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. A little breath of fresh air. This is why we
I'm probably one of the most commercial guests they've ever had here. Now, this is public radio. There's no commercials.
Yeah, no commercials.
So, but like, if there was, it'd be what? Guys?
Tweed suits, probably.
Really? Birkenstocks? I don't know. VW vans with psychedelic paintings?
Volvos. Sushi.
God's eyes?
What are those?
That's that when you take yarn and you keep doing it over and over again.
Oh, right.
The leading sailors.
It's the people who did that who have now grown up.
Oh, the people who have sold out and have no problem selling floppy disks now.
That's right. Come on. Well, you like this in high school.
I used to be a hippie. Now I work for Dow.
You're not old enough to have been a hippie.
No, I was never a hippie. I grew up in the 70s. I grew up listening to KC and the Sunshine Band and this Journey. It was a horrible time.
It must have been hard for you.
Yeah, well, then punk came along and it was a real fresh breath there,
What did you listen to when you were in high school?
Ramones, Sex Pistols.
The good stuff.
The oldies. I get sentimental now. I go, God, they don't write a song like that, I don't want to be a pinhead no more. Boy, those were the old days of music, Now everybody Wang Chung tonight. What does that mean? When I used to see a show, a guy came out, he overdosed, cut his chest up with razors. That was entertainment.
I can feel this slowly slipping out of my control here as we go on.
No, you'll be complete control.
I'm in complete control. Come on, will you like...
The egg of interviews. I'm in control now.
I don't recall feeling that way.
It'll be much painless on all of us if we just throw the notes out immediately.
You think so?
Yeah.
All right.
No, don't do that. I can't improv.
You have to be... All right, listen. Will you like this?
I'm not a comedian. I'm a loud dancer. See, if I say something like that, it takes all the pressure off. If I'm not funny, people go, hey.
You know what you remind me of? You remind me of this naughty little boy who kind of runs up to people, does something bad, gets caught at it, and then gets this little look on his face and says, please don't hit me. Please don't punish me.
Little Catholic boy. Oh, yeah, definitely. I think I was on Mary Hartley's program, and she says...
Who's Mary Hartley? Morning program. Sorry.
Janie Vacuumhead. I can tell you that I capitalized.
I listen to the radio in the morning. Give me a break.
You missed last year when I was the biggest star ever in America.
I did. I was out of the country. I missed it completely. I'm sorry. I had you on anyway, didn't I?
Yeah. I can tell you people are dead who aren't even. Abe Vigoda, did you know he died when you were away?
Did he?
No, but you would know. You were gone for 4 years.
That's right.
That Clara woman died.
Does it hurt your voice to do that?
To do what? To talk like me?
Yeah.
That voice. Let's burst a bubble. You know, if you hear Bob Guthrie in the middle of the night, he'll talk like a floppy-disk salesman. He'll go, hello, how are you?
See?
But, you know, I don't know. Do I talk like, does it hurt?
It sounds like, you know, if you have to do that for...
I don't know. You know, dissecting comedy crushes all the humor out of it, you know? I mean, Alice Cooper's career was over immediately after he was golfing with George Burns, you know? So, I'm a capitalist whore, and I'll milk this guy's as long as I can.
All right. Did you do this when you started out, when you were
17? My ex has always been motivated by fear and terror. Yeah. I mean, my early on, my performance, how lofty of me. I would do shows where I just read a Dear John letter or cry.
Cry.
And that would be my set.
Everyone would
applaud. Got a herring. I used to go, could I have a herring from the audience, please? And my roommate would be out there. And he goes, you want this one? I go, well, thank you very much. And then I got it. And I remember one particular night where a woman started vomiting in the front row.
How pleasant.
Yeah, so I put the mic right down, you know, so everyone could share that.
Share
the
that
warmth of that. Yeah, the love of that. And then, yeah, it was my own fault, though. I let the herring go bad a little bit before. And then people were booing me, right? It was like, oh, but, you know, like all these red meat eaters are complaining that I got a herring on stage. You know, what do you think? A cow goes, I'm getting old. Why don't you just shoot me now and make some patties out of my carcass?
No, they all die of cancer.
Well, they all die. Yeah. Vitamin C gets to them?
Something like that. Something
yeah, I know.
Like
hey, you know these animals are diseased.
Yeah. Well, what can I say? I eat them anyway.
Do you?
Yeah.
Really? So,
you don't? You're a vegetarian?
Yeah, actually. Just out of the fact that I'm 25 and I've got the colon of an 85-year-old man. That's a real pleasant thought. Do people eat lunch during the show?
No. Sometimes.
Thank God. Oh, my colon
There might be
hurts.
Some people that play it during breakfast. So,
yeah,
they've,
I get out of bed at 25. I go, ugh. You know, that's not a good sign.
Was this the herring thing, was this before Boston or after
that
Boston?
That was in Boston.
Boston?
Yeah. Then I've always never really done traditional, you know. Boy, I have a hard time meeting women. Duh. You know.
Did you write the stuff that you do?
No, I like to steal as much stuff from the guys coming up.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, I go to an open mic night. I go, hey, I can use that. No one ever heard of this guy.
Are people stealing your stuff now?
I don't know. How can you steal babbling? You know, they're welcome to my act. It's fine. You know, I see people doing stuff like that I've done, but I don't get caught up in someone stole my act because if I only did the same thing every time I went on stage, yeah, I'd be mad.
Yeah.
But my act now is not like the HBO special. It always changes. There was way too much irresponsible stuff in my act on the HBO show because I made jokes about stabbing someone in the head, and I really don't find that funny. I find it pretty irresponsible because there's way too much violence anymore.
Is that why you decided to revamp now all the material that it said? I read that you.
I read that in the paper this morning.
Yeah, so did I.
I mean, I'll be using old ancient material whenever. See, I just don't do jokes, you know? Like, you hear a guy go, jokes to me are lies, right? It's a complete lie. A guy comes in and goes, I got a joke for you. Like that's not painful enough for me to hear jokes everywhere I go. Hey, you want to hear a joke? No, I would rather you slit open my intestines with a rusty razor. So I'll go, you know, okay, a guy goes, two guys walk into a bar, and the guy drinks a beer, and then this monkey puts his genitalia into the guy's drink. See, I'm cleaning it up,
yeah,
right?
Real clean.
Well, that's clean. I mean, I didn't say the
no,
D
no,
word,
no,
did
don't,
I?
No. You haven't said any of the words yet, thank you.
So don't worry. I'm not going to do what I do on Howard Stern.
Good.
Heaven forbid you actually had ratings, you know.
What do you mean? We have ratings.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, you don't compete.
Yes,
yeah,
so we don't have to compete for advertising, Tom.
This is Gandhi radio, man. Passive radio.
So, passive-aggressive radio.
So
what are we talking about?
Yeah, so a guy, how jokes are lies, right? A guy walks into a bar, monkey sticks his genitalia in a drink, and this is where they lose me. As soon as the guy goes, and then the guy says, well, if that really happened, you don't need a punchline. I mean, that would be hilarious to me. I'm crude. If I saw that, I would have blood coming out of my eyes. I'd be laughing so hard. So don't lie to me. Don't say two guys walk into a bar. They didn't walk into a bar. That didn't happen. Monkey genitalia and a beverage would make my head explode.
Mm.
So pretty much I've been trying to get rid of all those kind of jokes out of my ass.
You also don't do jokes about homosexuals. You don't do sexist jokes.
Yeah, no, actually, you know, on a given night, because I babble so much, sure. See, I'm everything. I am a racist. I am a sexist. But in reality, I don't act on those things. Like in my act, I say I have homosexual tendencies. Now, the key word is tendency. They last for a billionth of a second. I look at, I don't know who's been doing it for me lately, but Rob Lowe or something. I go, hey, I wouldn't mind kissing him. And then the other half of my brain goes, it's a guy! You know?
Right.
Stop it, you know? So, I mean, I have those things and I don't act on it. But, you know, it's kind of weird. It's just, there's just a lot of homophobia in the clubs today. And I'm not above accidentally, you know, having a cheap gay joke. Mm. But I'm everything. I mean, I'm a mass of contradictions and I'm full of it.
My guest is comedian Bob Goldthwait.
I'm a loud dancer.
You're a loud, should I say that? Loud,
my guest out of the has comedy. Been. Actually, lately everyone's going, this screaming comedy thing. Well, how do you convey anger? Am I supposed to go up there and go, hi, I'm really mad, duh, you know? Or, hi, I'm really scared, you know, you're a great crowd, duh.
Do you have to wind yourself up to get on stage?
No, I just have to buy a paper, you know? I mean.
You're going to get angry. Did you watch President Reagan's speech?
No, but I called up a buddy of mine, and he gave me his version of it, which was much more entertaining anyways. But, see, this is kind of funny because there might be peace in Nicaragua, and I was going to be doing a benefit for the AIDS of, you know, out in Los Angeles to trying to get some lobbying to stop contra-aid, right? And like, I'm talking to these guys promoting it now, and they're going, well, I don't know. What are we going to do if peace breaks out? It was just going to be such a good show. What are we going to do? You know? So we're wondering if peace breaks out or not.
Maybe it will. Then you can make jokes about
peace. It's a frightening thought. About peace? I don't know. See, like, in my act, I'm saying, you know, I've got a bigger chance of getting killed by dying from homelessness than a Stalinista, like, coming up and beating me to death with a stick.
Or riding in an airplane. You've done routines about air traffic controllers.
Well, not routines.
Not
I
routines,
did more about the fact that Reagan fired the union, which is totally illegal, and everyone seems so perplexed why there's so many airplane crashes. Well, I don't know. Maybe Walt the janitor is not qualified to land a Boeing 707. You know, I think a guy's, like, experience should be a little bit more than his ability to win Space Invaders, you know, or Pong to land planes. But I don't blame Reagan, because blaming him for the way things are is like blaming Ronald McDonald when you get a bad cheeseburger. You know, neither of them run the company.
Now, I have heard that joke or that line now about 5 times on
from
different
me?
Yeah, a
different. Well, it's, you know, so I'm not that spontaneous.
No, but you've had to do about 200 different, what, about more than 200 interviews in the past year?
Oh, I do. Oh, probably over a couple hundred.
Yeah.
So when I come across a line that actually says how I feel, I tend to, like, remember it, you know? That's how I work. Because I think people think I'm going to come on here and, you know, come on the end and go, hey, how you doing? Pull my finger, you know, and have exploding shoes, which reminds me. On the way down here, we said something really funny. It was a clown supply house. Seriously, it was like, and we're just thinking like a bad day. Like a clown comes in and goes, what is this? These shoes, they don't explode. My God, I'm in the middle of my set. My exploding pants don't work. I go, okay, I'll go to the shoes. Nothing. Thank God I had a pie. You know, thank God I had a pie. What do you think you're dealing with? Some clown ass? Some bozo? Okay, I'll take a pound of the rubber dog poop and some of the funny balloon animals.
In these interviews, people always bring up the Police Academy movies.
Yeah,
I mean, let's face it.
How a lot of people got to know me, unfortunately.
I did.
Yeah, well, see, look, but I've been in clubs for a long time, and then I made the police lobotomies. I can't, see, I'd make a lot of fun about those, but I did them. See, so then I shouldn't really make fun of them. You know, and I continue to do them. Although they're going to go to work on Police Lobotomy 5, and I won't be in it.
Oh.
Yeah, that's so sad.
Very sad.
I'm really bummed out.
You used to say that you took these movies because, well, a truck pulls up and full
of
money.
Well, that was an extremely capitalist statement on my part. It was actually, I was being interviewed by this pinhead at the time, who was obviously extremely into wealth, and I'd be denying. See, you give a jerk money, and he's still a jerk, because I'm a jerk, and I've had money, and I've been broke, so I know that much. But the reason I do Police Academy is when I started comedy, I didn't walk in on a Saturday night and say, hi, I'm Bobcat, how you doing? I like to go on before your headliner, and I like to get paid a lot. No, when I started, I did, like, Monday night in front of a bunch of drunks at 2 o'clock in the morning. So if I allegedly want to make movies a career, I take every film. I've never yet turned down a Sidney Pollack film.
Have you been offered a Sidney Pollack film?
No.
Oh, well.
I don't say, Sid, sorry. I got to make Police Academy 5.
But to give you the chance to get that exposure, people who may not have seen you in clubs.
It's like being on Happy Days, you know? That's about the equivalent of it. But allegedly, I might be meeting David Lynch to do a small part in one of his movies. So you know it's going to be upball. It's going to be a real screwball, light, frothy comedy. You get the cat and
the
David
director
Lynch
of
together.
Eraserhead and Blue Velvet.
Blue Velvet.
Which is a good movie last year. Were you able to improvise on these movie sets at all?
No, only Burglar. Burglar, I improvised all my scenes, well, with the help of the director. I mean, it takes much more skill to let a guy riff than it does to try to control him. So Burglar was a riot, and on the police lobotomy, see, I would still be making them if there wasn't screaming fights, you know. Please, can I have your cooperation? We're trying to make an irreverent teen comedy here. Mm. You know. See, police academies just make a lot of cash. So, like, every single bad gas joke is weighed very heavily. And they come there with a sheet and they say, okay, we got to show this many breasts and we need this many car crashes and this many racial slurs, and then we'll have a hit movie.
Yeah. I'd like to talk about your new movie. That's coming up in after we take a short break.
You're more than welcome to it. I have no say in it. I'm powerless over you.
I'm Leanne Hansen. My guest is comedian Bob Goldthwait. And
see,
I think
getting by.
Yeah, I'm getting by. I'm all right. I'm all right. And
I'm not tearing you ahead.
Not at all. Not at all. Not intimidating in the least. And I think this is fresh air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Loud Dancer.
Loud Dancer?
He is well known for his appearances in Police Academy movies. He's also performed in clubs throughout his career, had a special on HBO, and has a new movie coming up called Hot to Trot. Is that the name of it?
Yeah, it's based on a true story, me with a talking horse.
Like Mr. Ed?
Mr. What?
You don't need... Oh, that's
no,
right.
You're, no, I
you're
don't
too
know Mr.
young.
Ed.
You're
just,
too young.
I'm just trying to plead innocent, you know. Hollywood just full of so many new ideas. Yeah, no, it's me and a talking animal. So I spent 3.5 months with this diseased animal breathing his pyrrhea breath in his face.
Did you get
actually, the horse is really cool. It's so weird. People hear me talking about Don. That's his name. And I get like, I go, well, you know, Don, you know, and they're like going, Bobcat, it's an animal.
Are you sort of a Bobcat personality?
I'm a Bobcat.
Again, you know?
No, I play, I'm more like a Judd Nelson in this one. I'm really good looking. Suddenly I got handsome. No, I'm a dirt bag. I made a career out of being a dirtbag. We're doing, I've told this story, too, about how the horse wouldn't look at me.
No, I haven't heard this one.
Oh, okay. Well, humor's antidote 1210 of a continuing series. The horse wouldn't look at me, so to get him to look at me, because I'm a guy, and that's pretty boring stuff for a horse, they would put another horse 20 feet behind him. And so the whole time he'd be going like, hey, who's that? Look at that. Look at that slice of heaven.
Reaction shots.
I felt
the
like,
horse.
Yeah, well, you never see the horse behind me. Actually, it was like talking to my agent, you know. It's like, hey, there's Bruce Willis. His career's taken off. He's not like you.
Bruce Willis was originally supposed to be in Burglar, right?
He was the lead, and Whoopi played a lesbian, and I ended up playing Whoopi's part, and then he ended up doing wine cooler ads or something.
Right. Now, this part I had heard was originally supposed to be played by Joan Rivers.
Yeah.
The part in Hot to Trot?
Yeah, I've yet to ever get a part that was originally designed for me. I'm like a scab, you know? Like anybody.
You are not. You are
I'm
not.
I'm a scab. I'm like anybody, you know, I'll be doing Coors ads next week at this rate. Anyone gets fired, I walk in.
You have, you're married now, you have a little girl. You're going to start doing daddy material like Robin
yeah.
Williams' daddy.
Yeah, I'm
going to
exploit my child for some cheap laughs.
Well,
that's
you know.
The reason I had a kid, because I needed a new 10 minutes.
No.
I'm. It's a very hard fence I'm on because I always have a feeling if you talk about something on stage, you're going to lose it. But on the other hand, I can only talk about what's going on with me, so it's really hard to talk. I do talk about my kid and family. Also, I like to talk about Anne occasionally just because if I don't, I get these misguided women backstage. And that's kind of bizarre because I never had a groupie when I bagged groceries for a living. Right. You know?
Did you do and that I'm in Syracuse?
I'm insulted when women are attracted to me because I've been on stage. Because what you're saying is that you didn't hear anything I had to say.
Mm. Do people expect you to be on when they meet you on the street?
No, because I can really suck on stage, so I don't think they expect me to be humorous all the time.
Oh, do they run up to you and yell in your face or something like that?
Yeah, you know, that's real pleasant. It's usually like when I'm out at a real nice restaurant. Crazy man! Yeah, I'm real crazy. How's your gazpacho, dear?
Do you do that voice in front of your daughter? She's, what, 7 months old?
Do I do that voice?
I mean, I can imagine it being rather frightening for a small child.
The way I act is comes out of terror and fear. And when I'm around my kid, very rarely am I nervous.
Yeah.
You know, because there's a chemical thing going off when you're around a kid. You have no say in it. It makes you a wimp.
Yeah.
It's a physical thing. It can't be mental. Because you could give the biggest jerk a baby and they'd start cooing and stuff. So I don't think I don't know. Being around a kid is pretty spiritual, wild stuff.
It is.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked about things on stage and then I felt bad afterwards because we had a pretty rough go of our delivery. And I was in there and we had a C-section. Mm-hmm. And this really did happen. A woman in the room said, "Would you like to cut the cord?" And I looked at her. I really said this. I said, "Isn't there anyone a little more qualified? I mean, why am I the guy you want to give a sharp thing to around an infant right now?"
But you did it.
Oh, I cut the cord. It's like it's set up like it's so easy. Right. They do it all the time. You know, they could have a janitor going, "Hey, Gern, what are you doing? Get in here, clip this kid." So then, but also my baby didn't go through the. You know, the Play-Doh fun factory of life. She didn't get her little head squished. So she came out just smiling and a big, big smile. Very wild. And it really made me PO'd. See, I'm trying to clean myself up for you.
Made you angry.
But see, like, if I swore, I'd drum up so much more publicity because, he was on the radio and he was so offensive. And see, I'll have to do 5 of these appearances to get the same impact of one right. Disgusting one.
Right. But see, dirty words are funny.
Oh, dirty words. I don't know if they're funny. It's the only way. I mean, I use the same language you would use if you drop something very heavy on your foot.
Right.
In my performance. You know, I don't talk about my genitals all that much. I seem to hold it a lot up there, but I was talking to someone about that. And someone was talking about how a lot of people do that, a lot of guys, Pryor and Robin Williams, and they noticed that I am kind of fond of that behavior too. And without getting lofty, someone said, "Well, it's because, like, you know, you're totally nude up there, you know." So I think that's probably it. Sometimes I tell people a lot more than I wish I had.
Mm. Did Robin Williams, established comics, give you any advice when you were starting out?
Yeah, it was pretty funny because, like, in my HBO special, I talked about Stallone not going to Vietnam. Mm-hmm.
You say he went to Sweden to coach a volleyball team?
Yeah, he
right?
did. He went to Sweden and taught girls gym soccer or volleyball or something. I don't know. Yeah, and so in the special, I said that in Rambo 2, he goes, "Do we win this time?" And I was going, "What, you know, the girls' volleyball championships?" "No, you're going to pretend you went this time. You know, let's face reality." So he makes $1 billion after exploiting the non-vets, you know, and I found that pretty evil. And then, you know, I talked about his porno movie, too, because I have that on tape, and if you can get a hold of it, it's pretty hilarious. You see everything, and then he does this hippie weird dance after he smokes pot. It's kind of funny. And so I talked about these things on my special, and Robin, I call up Robin, right? And he says to me, he called me, actually, when we were in the hospital with my baby and stuff. And he says, "Well, this special's going out, and, you know..." And I told him about the Stallone bit, and he goes, "Well, come on, Bob. You know, do you really think Stallone has got the time to sit there and watch your special?" Because, you know, also I said that we were talking about the Reagan stuff. And he says, "Stallone's not going to watch your special. Don't worry about it." Day after the show goes on the air, everywhere I went, I get these messages. "Call Sylvester Stallone," right? So I figured he just wanted to shoot the breeze.
Oh, you know, sure.
Me being the breeze. So, he told my manager he wanted to kill me and stuff. But I would have, I would have taken Stallone's call, but I would have wimped out. I would have said, "Geez, I'm sorry." Or on the other hand, I would have said, "Listen, you're a fascist, you know?" So I didn't talk to Stallone. And I figure the more I talk about it, the less chance he has of hurting me or one of my family members. So I take a lot of opportunity to try to talk about him,
you know? Take it out.
But I don't think he would actually hurt me. I'm sure, if you know, it'd be just some night owls and I get my Achilles tendon slit in an alley or something like that.
Every night you have to face.
But yeah, so I always call Robert on that. I call him up. Oh, Sylvester Stallone won't hear this.
Right.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Mork. Thanks for the advice.
Every night you have to face a sea of people, faces. You know, do you ever have anxiety dreams about this?
No, I have anxiety attacks up there. I mean, I get paid to have a breakdown every day. It cracks me up. You know, some days I sit there with the baby and the hibachi and you know, hanging out, being real mellow. And I go out there, I go, you know, maybe I don't feel like having a breakdown tonight. You know, maybe I just want to talk to you about computers.
And they say, no, you have to go out there and have the breakdown.
Well, that's how I feel. I talk about computers, you know. I just, you know, I don't have this obligation to my crowd to be a nut. If I did, I'd have to quit because I don't feel like doing old stuff all the time.
How did you get on The Tonight Show?
I didn't ever audition for The Tonight Show. The man who, he's been a really cool guy. He would see me perform and he would say, I wouldn't ask him. I wouldn't say, hey, can I come on the show? Because I know I'm not a Tonight Show act. But Joan Rivers put me on because it was like her last coup before she took off. 3 days before she left, she had me on the air. And the producer, I think... The producer or the director was out of town because that was another thing.
Yeah.
Because he called up my manager afterwards and he said, over my vacationing body, huh?
You've done Letterman as well, David Letterman.
Yeah.
Show. Do you have to do different stuff for that show? I mean...
Well, no, I actually don't know what I'm doing. On The Tonight Show, I just came out and cried and explained that my dog... I was introduced as Bob Goldthwait and his dog JoJo, and then I just came out and cried and explained that my dog got hit by a truck earlier that day.
And everyone thought that was hysterical.
No, they were all sad. And then I had a man come out who I said was my dad and made him jump through a hoop, and I fed him snacks, and then I played God Bless America. And he rode around a tricycle holding American flags.
Mm. You do Elvis material. Oh, you've done it.
I've talked about him.
Well, yeah,
what is going on now? Did he cut a new record or something?
No, he's been dead 10 years.
Well, what, is he going to come out? Is he the phoenix? Does he come out of his ashes?
Reading some of the newspapers, you'd think so.
Yeah,
because, you know, the portraits of him about what he would look like, what he was 50. There was even an astrologer who did a thing about what Elvis would be doing.
Well, that thing's happening Sunday. Maybe Elvis is going to come.
The harmonic convergence.
The harmonic convergence is the reappearance of Elvis Presley.
You think so?
I don't know. I was in Los Angeles and somebody, you know, the highway shooting. Someone threw a pit bull into another guy's window and killed him.
Oh, how pleasant.
No, that's not true, but I faked out.
You did,
You took the bait.
You did,
look at
I
that
did.
Hook at him
no
up.
Wonder
that
they call you.
That hook hurts.
What do they call you, the pit bull of comedy?
No, there's a guy I know they call the pit bull of comedy, actually.
Yeah.
He's had that name for a long time.
You did that voice that sort of, you know, yuppie. You do an excellent Elvis impression.
I don't do it, actually.
You do his voice.
I was doing a show, people were like, people who listen and watch you will say anything, so that's
it's not
me.
True. It's not true.
I got off stage. I've been doing Bono from U2, and some poor kid, she was really sweet. She goes, you sing better than U2. And it was so endearing and sweet, but it is that blindness people get when you're performing, and it's kind of scary.
Yeah.
Because you can, on a given night, if I want to get beat up mentally, I can go out and find that person in the audience, grab them and say, tell me I suck. And they'll go, boy, I hate you. I work with people like you. You are so offensive. And I'll go, yeah, I am worthless. Or then on that night, if I wanted to find someone who would just go, everything you do is wonderful, I could find them. And that's why I tend to hide from my fans a lot, because I don't want to be told either up or down.
All right. We only have a couple of seconds left. Do you think you're going to age gracefully?
I always talk about that.
No, huh?
No, I don't worry about that. I was talking about my daughter, you know. It's like, I'll be going, how come your little friends never, you know, come to the door? Why do they pick you up at the end of the driveway?
Okay. My guest has been comedian Bob Goldthwait.
Loud dancer!
Loud dancer Bob Goldthwait. I'm Leanne Hansen.
Thanks for having me on, Leanne.
You're absolutely welcome, Bob. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air. You must be quiet now. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is, you have to be quiet, Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Broadway composer Cy Coleman.
Oh, you will not. You're a liar.
I will, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia.
Guilt
this is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Leanne Hansen, filling in for Terry Gross while she's on vacation. Coming up, photographer Ted Spagna talks about capturing the images of sleep. His nighttime photos of people and animals are both art and science. Also, rhythm guitarist and singer Marty Gross performs a couple of songs from the good old days, one of them the Fanny Brice hit, Rose of Washington Square. And critic Ken Tucker reviews Double Indemnity and Naked Spur, a couple of classic films now available on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First News from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. On this week's performing spot, we welcome back rhythm guitarist Marty Gross. When he was a kid, Marty began fooling around with an old Hawaiian ukulele, which he found in the attic of his New York City home. Soon his interest turned to jazz. During the 40s, when Charlie Christian's single-line electric guitar style was having a great influence on the jazz of the time, Marty was drawn more to the shuffle rhythm of the swing band acoustic guitarists. And today, he's one of the few players keeping the art of jazz acoustic rhythm guitar alive. We asked Marty Gross to play a couple of songs connected with the two cities he's lived in since he began his career, New York and Chicago.
Chicago, Chicago, that toddling town. Chicago, Chicago, I'll show you around. Bet your bottom dollar you'll lose your blues in Chicago. The town that Mayor Daley could not shut down. Bet your bottom dollar, State Street, that great street. I just want to say, they do things they don't do on Broadway. Say, you'll have the time of your life. I saw a man, he danced with his wife in Chicago. Chicago, my hometown. State Street, that great street. I just want to say, they do things they don't do on Broadway. Say, you'll have the time of your life. I saw a man, he danced with his wife in Chicago. In Chicago. In Chicago. My hometown. Down, down, down. Down, 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 down. Yes, Chicago. Chicago was a place where I ran away to when I was 18 years old. Tried to make my fame and fortune. I made neither, but I had a pretty good time because there were a lot of jazz joints. There were some places that had very long hours, and the musicians would let almost anybody, even the most unskilled neophyte like myself, play just in order to get some time off from being on the bandstand. And that was great experience. There were a lot of good years in Chicago. I worked all kinds of saloons. I worked in places where
Girls swung on swings. I worked in places where every night was billed as New Year's Eve, and it was a great convention town. You played long hours and you played hard, but when you were young, that was good training. After a while, I came back to New York, and I'd like to do a New York song, but all the New York songs are so, most of them, are so cliched by now, they're so overdone, that I'd like to do this one, which is about a place in New York. It was featured in the 1920s Ziegfeld Follies by Fanny Brice. I didn't know until later in my life that Fanny Brice had been a stand-up vaudeville entertainer and a theater entertainer and the toast of Broadway because, of course, in the early 40s, Fanny Brice was known through a radio program called Baby Snooks, and all we ever heard of her, she played the part of a little 2 or 3 year old Muppet who said things like, "Why, Daddy?" and "I fall down and go boom," and had lines like that. And it was totally a different character that was revealed later on to be the Fanny Brice that sang this song and made it a hit in those days, called Rosa Washington Square.
She's the rose of Washington Square. She's wilting down there in basement air. They ask her to pose with or without her clothes. They say her Roman nose just seems to please particular people, both. She's got plenty of those in secondhand clothes and nice long hair. She's got those Broadway vampires lashed to the mast. She's got no future. Ah, what a past. She's the rose of Washington Square. Got plenty of those in secondhand clothes and nice long hair. She's got those Broadway vampires lashed to the mast. She's got no future. What a past. She's the rose of Washington Square. She's the rose of Washington Square. Rose of Washington Square.
Rhythm guitarist Marty Gross. He now makes his home in Brooklyn. Marty Gross records for Statiris, a record label based in Georgia. This is Fresh Air. My guest is photographer Ted Spagna. For the past 10 years, he's been photographing people and animals while they sleep. Early on, his work caught the attention of sleep researchers, and he began sharing his photos with them. This collaboration led to scientific discoveries about the dream cycle and other patterns of human sleep behavior. Spanje became interested in animals after he took pictures of a friend who slept with a cat. His latest collection of sleep portraits was taken at the Boston and Miami zoos. It's called Peaceable Kingdom. Spanje was a filmmaker when he bought his first time-lapse camera, and when we spoke, he told me about his early work in sleep photography.
It was very difficult at first. The very first subject was myself, and it was very crude, very soft, with a lot of technical difficulties regarding the camera. But after a couple of months, I solved it and finally coerced my parents, literally coerced my parents into being subjects for me. And then when people saw the work, they responded to what it represented and to what it was.
What do you mean they responded to what it was? What was their reaction?
They were very surprised.
They
had never seen anyone sleep like that. First of all, I take what I call kind of God's point of view. I mount the camera directly over the sleeper and look straight down. And that's a point of view one never, ever sees unless you put a hole in the floor above someone's bedroom. The other thing that surprises people is what people look like. When I show them portraits of myself, it's obvious that there is another self that exists in sleep that is not apparent in a waking state.
What's the difference?
That's hard to put into words, but I would say it's related to the total relaxation of the face and the muscles in the face, a kind of trance-like state. I don't know how to put it into words, but there is a very, very obvious physiological difference in the way people appear, especially in their faces.
How was it that sleep behaviorists, most notably J. Allen Hobson, got interested in your work?
We met while I was teaching at Harvard University. I was teaching film production at the Carpenter Center for Visual Arts, and the director of the center, a man by the name of Bob Gardner, suggested that I get in touch with Dr. Hobson, who is a sleep researcher at the med school and a man of some international reputation. When he saw the work, he just became very excited by it, because in this art of mine was innovative science.
I'm actually surprised that no one had ever thought of this before.
So am I. Sleep research has been on the scene since 1952, when rapid eye movement sleep was discovered in University of Chicago. And none of the scientists ever thought of taking pictures like this. And I come along with my intervalomic camera and take these pictures, and it turns out it really reveals something significant.
Now this, what do you call it, intervalonic camera, what we're essentially talking about is sort of time-lapse photography. You take
Yes.
a series of photographs over a long period of time.
Yes. It's a long story, but to make a long story short, I acquired a camera in an auction with a bulk back, and enabled me to put 450 exposures into the camera, so that the camera could really stay unattended for a long period of time, and with the motor, expose up to 450 separate images. And what I did was I put an intervalometer on the camera and programmed the camera to take a photograph every 15 minutes.
Did you decide to take it every 15 minutes sort of by trial and error, or did you actually apply some sort of scientific method to this?
Well, the scientific method and the trial and error kind of converge. A 36 exposure film cassette is the standard film cassette you have. And early on in the work, I didn't have the bulk back, or the back which afforded the opportunity to take to use long rolls of film. So basically what I did is I divided 36 into 8 hours and came upon a number which was near 15 minutes. And turns out that in subsequent experiments with at Harvard Medical School, at shorter and longer intervals, it turned out that the 15-minute interval was about right for an adult human.
Why? Because the sleep cycle sort of conforms to these mathematics?
Because it was the resolution of the view, that is, the resolution of taking a photograph every 15 minutes, clearly showed the 90 to 120-minute sleep cycles.
The photographs are laid out in such a way that they almost look like, I don't know, frames of a film. And you said that you did start off as a filmmaker. Are there similarities here in what you were doing as a filmmaker and what you're doing now as a photographer?
Yes, I think there is. Points about these sleep portraits is the subject is not only the sleeper, but the subject in a very real sense is time. We are looking at a person over time, and in my mind, these portraits really begin to address on a profound level what a portrait is. What does a portrait mean? What does it mean to have a photographic portrait? And film is a medium which really springs out of the phenomenon of time. Scenes change, characters develop, scenes switch, they fade in and fade out. It's really a medium of time.
Who was it? Was it Fellini that said film is the dream of the waking mind?
Yes, it was. And that's a quote I read while I was studying film in graduate school. It stuck with me.
You're also taking pictures of animals.
Yes.
Do they behave differently when they're sleeping than humans, say?
Yeah, it depends on the sleeper. I've just had a show here in Boston, which will be traveling around the country. And in that show, there is a portrait of an adult male gorilla. And I have to tell you that I was astounded by how similar he sleeps to an adult human. I didn't expect it, but he sleeps very much like my friend would sleep, another adult male. One happens to be a gorilla and one happens to be Homo sapien. But apparently it's all controlled by a part of the brain called the brainstem, and we share that brain architecture with higher mammals.
So it seems as though now zoologists and people who are involved with animal behavior are probably doing the same sort of thing that Mr. Hobson did in studying humans and the way they sleep.
I think so. My experience with both the Metropolitan Boston Zoos and the Miami Metro Zoo is where I took most of the photographs, both of those places. We learned enough and just saw enough. Let me put it this way. What we discovered in both situations, in both cases, was that this technique could really be useful to the zoologists and to the biologists at the zoos. It can enlighten them about many ways to improve animal management techniques.
Can you give us an example?
Well, yeah, I can give you a concrete example. When I was down in Miami, there is an exhibit in which there is a flock of flamingos. They had built their nests out of mud and laid some eggs, and recently they had been leaving the nests and the eggs in the middle of the night, and it disturbed the animal keepers down there because they didn't understand why this was happening. They thought maybe the animals were disturbed by the public or this or that. They weren't really sure, and my sleep camera caught a marauding raccoon in the act of harassing these flamingos, and at 2 o'clock, between 2 and 3 o'clock every morning, in the dead of night, this raccoon would come about and scare the hell out of these flamingos, and they would just take off. They would leave their nests and their eggs. So this one concrete example of how my technique has helped in a very real sense.
Do you think the scientific applications of the work that you're doing has diminished your art in any way?
No. I think that in a sense, we have a lot to unlearn about art and science. Today's society has tended to separate art and science in a kind of unnatural way, in my view. And one of the nice things about my work is that it shows that you can have fine art and innovative science together in the same thing, having a kind of mutually help each other in a sense. It's both science and art. It's a double-edged sword, if you will. I think that's part of the strength of the work. I don't see one excluding or one competing with the other.
Ted Spagna, thank you very much for talking to us.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it very much. Goodbye.
Photographer Ted Spagna's latest photo collection, Peaceable Kingdom, has been seen in Boston, and plans are underway for the exhibit to travel to other cities. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who's hosting the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Leanne.
What's up today?
Well, this being a Friday, I think I'm going to tell you all about our cultural stories today. We offer Cuban balladeers tonight. We hear from Pablo Milenes, one of the founders of the Latin American New Song Movement. He's a Cuban singer. He's rarely seen in the United States. Mostly, he operates as a cultural ambassador throughout Latin America from Cuba. Tonight, we remember Elvis. We debunk the myth of Lassie, and we vindicate Macbeth. Now, Leanne, which one of those would you like to hear more about?
Well, first of all, what's the myth of Lassie? What do you mean? He's not a dog?
The myth is he's smiling at Timmy. Well, he's not smiling at Timmy, that is.
Thanks, Renee. All Things Considered is coming up later on National Public Radio. If you feel like feasting your eyes on some good home video fare, our critic Ken Tucker has some tips. Two old movies, Double Indemnity, starring Fred McMurray, and The Naked Spur with Jimmy Stewart. Now, those of you who remember these actors as good guys are in for a few surprises.
Double Indemnity, recently released on video cassette, is one of the most mean-spirited great movies ever made. Add up the facts. Based on a James M. Cain novel, screenplay by Raymond Chandler, directed by Billy Wilder, and you've got three layers of cynicism here. What makes Double Indemnity exhilarating is that this isn't self-pitying cynicism. When stars Barbara Stanwyck and Fred McMurray plot to bump off Stanwyck's drippy husband for the insurance dough, the filmmaker's bleak view of humanity takes on a sleek, witty energy. Baby boomers who know Fred McMurray only from his days as the fumbling father on My Three Sons will be pleasantly shocked by his role here as a larcenous insurance salesman. McMurray makes tough guy wisecracks out of the side of his mouth, and his leer at Barbara Stanwyck's legs as she saunters down the stairs must be one of the sexiest moments in the history of the cinema. Here are Stanwyck and McMurray after their first meeting, already flirting like mad.
Mr. Neff, why don't you drop by tomorrow evening around 8:30? He'll be in then.
Who?
My husband. You were anxious to talk to him, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, but I'm sort of getting over the idea, if you know what I mean.
There's a speed limit in this state, Mr. Neff. 45 miles an hour.
How fast was I going, officer?
I'd say around 90.
Suppose you get down off your motorcycle and give me a ticket.
Suppose I let you off with a warning this time.
Suppose it doesn't take.
Suppose I have to whack you over the knuckles.
Suppose I bust out crying and put my head in your shoulder.
Suppose you try putting it on my husband's shoulder.
That tears it. 8:30 tomorrow evening, ma'am.
That's what I suggested.
You be here, too?
I guess so. I usually am.
Same chair, same perfume, same anklet.
I wonder if I know what you mean.
I wonder if you wonder.
That zippy repartee barely disguises the undercurrent of tension and malevolence that runs through Double Indemnity like an electrical wire. In a sense, the movie is even more effective nowadays because we all carry around in our heads the image of Fred McMurray as an unimpeachably good TV dad. His cruel smirk here has taken on a fresh shock. 40 years later, Lawrence Kasdan tried to remake Double Indemnity as a tropical film noir called Body Heat, starring William Hurt and Kathleen Turner. It's also on video cassette, but it's not as good. Kasdan wanted us to be sympathetic to his sweaty lovers in a way Billy Wilder never did. A director closer in sensibility to Wilder is Anthony Mann, whose 1952 movie The Naked Spur is also just out on video cassette. The Naked Spur might be described as a Western film noir. Mann cast James Stewart against type as a mean, stubborn cowboy out to collect the reward on an outlaw played by Robert Ryan. Stewart played a bad guy frighteningly well. Recently, people compared Oliver North to the Jimmy Stewart of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Maybe a congressional committee should check out the Jimmy Stewart of The Naked Spur and then get a search warrant to look through Ollie North's video collection.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He reviewed Double Indemnity and The Naked Spur, now on home video. Here's what's coming up on the next Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with actress Rebecca Wells. She plays Loretta Sue Endless, a talkative Southern beautician, in the one-woman show Splitting Hairs. Also, jazz critic Francis Davis will review the new album by the quartet Sphere. And television critic David Bianculli will preview the new fall lineup. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to hear from you. Write us with your comments and suggestions. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional assistance from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Leanne Hansen. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.